You are listening to Think Theory Radio.
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 Radio. Radio. Radio.
Hello and welcome to Think Theory Radio, the show that brings you topics outside the mainstream realm of thought and ideas to make you think. And I'm your host, Damien Perdue, your guide on this metaphysical ride of audio delights. And of course, I'm joined by the man behind the boards, Pauly C.
Yo, yo, yo.
Or should I say the man on the pots? Yeah, because C stands for cannabis today.
And the pots.
And the pots on the board.
Yeah,
see, it all ties together.
420!
Today is 420, the holiest of high days, or the highest of holy days. Although, of course, for those of us that partake in the sacred healing herb, every day is a holiday in celebration of cannabis. And in honor of 420... we have a special guest, very lucky to have Chris Bennett. He is a cannabis activist, researcher, historian, and author of books like Liber 420, Cannabis, Magical Herbs, and the Occult, Green Gold, The Tree of Life, Cannabis and the Soma Solution, and Cannabis, Lost Sacrament of the Ancient World. Welcome to the show, Chris, and happy 420.
Happy 420 to you as well.
Yeah, appreciate you coming on, man. It's serendipitously worked out that my show is on 420 this year.
Nice.
And before we get into some of the your writings, which are insanely extensive, if I must say, I wanted to know a little bit about more about you starting off. How did you get into cannabis activism and what led you down the road of researching the ancient origins of the plant?
I've been smoking grass for like 50 years. I started when I was like 12 years old or something, right?
Yeah.
But I hadn't really got into activism until I was in my late 20s, and I found out about the industrial applications of cannabis, hemp, industrial hemp. I was living out on Vancouver Island where there was a lot of controversy about the logging of old-growth rainforests. Mm-hmm. And when I found out 1 acre of hemp could produce as much paper as 4 acres of trees over the same 20-year period, I became interested in it as a solution to the situation with jobs versus the environment, you know. And I started getting into it. And then around that time, I had a really powerful religious experience using marijuana. And I was like, was there anything to that, or was I just like tripping out? Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, if there was something to it, then other people will have had similar experiences somewhere. And I decided I'd start, you know, collecting whatever I could to show that, you know, and that led to my last 5 books over the last 35 years.
And could you explain what was that religious experience you had? Or is it too personal?
Well, it was like, this was like in 1989, 90, and it was a number of things that happened that brought it about. The first of these was there was a big controversy here in Canada involving the Catholic Church and child molestation. They'd been running an orphanage here in Canada, and it turned out the priests in the 50s and 60s and 70s had molested a lot of young boys. And I was like, you know, wow, that's weird. I thought religion was something different than that. And I thought, I'm going to read the Bible. And I was working as a night watchman in a fish plant at that time. And I started reading it, and I just couldn't get into it. I kind of forgot about it. But then shortly after that, the Gulf War started in Iraq. And one night I was working in this fish plant about 2 a.m. reading the newspaper. And there was a sermon by a Pat Robertson being advertised. It was Revelations 18, the fall of Babylon. And he was tying in the Gulf War with the Book of Revelation. And I thought, well, I'm going to read the Book of Revelation right now. You know, I've seen the omen when I was a kid. I think getting close to the end of the millennia, everybody was kind of pumped for apocalyptic type thought. We still are. It's like an obsession of our culture. And so I started reading the Book of Revelation at the beginning of the story. There, John puts a scroll in his mouth, and he eats it. It tastes as sweet as honey in his mouth, but it turns bitter in his stomach, and he begins to prophesy. And I was like, what did he eat? And then it goes on how they're wearing sackcloth. And there's all these billowing clouds of incense for the prayers of the saints. And I got to the end of the book of Revelation, and it says, on either side of the river of life stood the tree of life, bearing 12 manners of fruit, yielding its fruit each month, and the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. And when I read that, I had this like really powerful experience where I felt like light just poured into my body, and this information came into me that this was a reference to cannabis and all its industrial uses, its medical qualities, and how it can unite humanity. Now, of course, Book of Revelation was written, you know, for a first century audience. It's all about Rome. But nonetheless, it's become kind of a symbol in the collective consciousness of humanity. And to modern Christian scientists, we're in that time period now of the apocalypse. I don't know that I believe it's so much of a prophecy as more of like symbolic or something like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, here I am, you know, 35 years later in 5 books, and cannabis is indeed the plant for the healing of the nations. And it's not just the biblical traditions. You know, in India, it goes back to the Vedic religion and still a part of Hinduism and offered to Shiva, the oldest continually worshipped god on earth. It had a role in Taoism and ancient China. There were quatrains written about cannabis, like first a yin, then a yang. No one knows what I do. Jade buds, the holy hemp for the one that lived apart. It had roles in Buddhism, Sikhism, in the Islamic world. There's a fascinating history for cannabis. So it's really been, you know, like global. And many people over the millennia have discovered these spiritual qualities of cannabis. And it's really a fascinating history.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, that's reminding me of when I first started smoking, and you know, of course, it was, you know, I was a kid, I was starting to get high. But when I started to learn about the actual industrial properties and the health properties of cannabis, and just, you know, the cannabis seed alone, I kind of had a religious metaphor for the oil industry versus cannabis, right? Where you have this dominant oil industry, oil that comes from, you know, under the earth, kind of like where hell is, you know, metaphorically. And then cannabis, which is this plant, this tree of life, which could be used as oil, as paper, as, you know, you could build bricks and you can feed yourself, you know. And I thought, well, here you have like the devil versus God in these two, you know, kind of earthly sources.
It's like we're heading down two paths, you know. And I think in the United States, this election, it's going to be very cannabis oriented. You know, Biden's clearly talking about rescheduling, and the Republicans are looking at the opposite way. You know, they definitely are. You know, the Republican Party is not friends of marijuana traditionally, and you know, it's an important issue. We are facing these two different futures. Cannabis, in many ways, represents the environmental, eco-friendly path we could take, and the Koch brothers and big oil, you know, they're taking us into hell, man. We're in the midst of climate change, you know, climate change that we could possibly reverse by converting to things like industrial hemp.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, not to mention you mentioned kind of this, the Christian right, and they're the ones like these kind of eschatologists and want to bring about that, you know, apocalypse, and the other side is the ones kind of actually want to save the climate and everything.
You know, it does seem to be kind of wound up with things. You know, we look at what's happening in Israel right now, the so-called Holy Land, and it's, you know, they're getting close to battle with Iran, and the horrors, what's happening with the people in Gaza. But this is a very important place in cannabis history. My latest book, Cannabis, the Lost Sacrament of the Ancient World, is really about, you know, the Holy Land and the role of cannabis there. For years I've been writing about this linguistic theory of Sula Bennett, who in the 1930s suggested the Hebrew terms canna and cannabossum were references to cannabis, and these appear 5 or 6 times in the Old Testament text. And she said these were references to cannabis that were mistranslated as calamus when the Hebrew texts were translated into the Greek and then later Latin. These mistakes followed through. But in 2020, you know, it seemed like this, I wrote about this, but it seemed like it was just destined to be a linguistic theory because it was unprovable. There were different candidates for these canna references, calamus, lemongrass, gingergrass, all sorts of things people were suggesting. And I always felt it was the strongest case for cannabis, but it seemed like it was destined to be just a theory until 2020, when they discovered a temple site that was discovered in the 1960s at Tel Arad, Jerusalem, and they did analysis in 2020 of an altar that was inside the temple area in a small enclosed room, and they found that there were resins of hashish on there, cannabis resins, they suspect hashish, that was burnt in a small chamber that was referred to as the House of Yahweh. It was an oracular chamber where they would burn this incense and they would speak to the Lord. And it shows, you know, that these Hebrew references were in fact references to cannabis, because the references appear in the exact same context as this cannabis that was discovered in this temple at Tel Arad, Jerusalem.
And that's another amazing thing, too. I mean, with archaeology now, and especially how it relates to cannabis, is we're finding more and more evidence of the ancient use and how important it was to humans. I mean, you've written about, you know, in several of your articles and in your books about how far back it goes. And this is probably one of the oldest plants that humans have cultivated.
Yeah, well, Carl Sagan, as well as Terence McKenna and the German botanist Christian Rach, all speculated that hemp was likely our first agricultural crop. Archaeological-wise, there's evidence of what is believed to be hemp growth from Czechoslovakia going back 24,000 years. Elizabeth Whalen Barber, probably the foremost authority on ancient textiles, suggests that tools used for the production and decordation of hemp from the stalks go back 28,000 years. We have evidence of hemp cloth, Taiwan and cattle hayak going back about 10,000 years. And these are far apart cultures, so these are independent traditions. And, you know, ritual use goes back, evidence for that goes back like 5,500 years in Ukraine and Romania, where it was used in funerary rituals, 5,200 years in Spain, where it was used religiously mixed with wine, apparently. So, you know, this relationship we have with cannabis, I would say, you know, could well be our oldest medicine. The religious traditions are older than any existing religious traditions of cannabis use as well.
Yeah, and it's pretty amazing the lineage of it used in spiritual practices, funerary rituals. And you were mentioning, you were talking about, you know, reading the Bible and everything and the story of the Garden of Eden. And I was reading your one article about the mother goddess and the tree of life. And, you know, and that whole time it was kind of crazy, because actually last week I did a show about the serpent mythology and the tree of life being kind of symbolizing Asherah and the mother goddess. And then I see your article and you're tying it into cannabis. And I was like, oh, wow, this is great. Can you break that down?
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize, you know, I would say most people that believe in the Bible don't realize that at one time Yahweh, that's Jehovah of the Bible, had a wife, Asherah. Mm-hmm. And this is well established now. You know, biblical scholars know about this. You can easily find this information out for yourself if you think that I'm up in outer space with this. But Yahweh had a wife, and there's descriptions that refer to Yahweh and his Asherah. One of the special things about this site at Temple of Tel Arad, where this cannabis was found, was it's a site that was known for the combined worship of Yahweh and Asherah. There were two altars inside this temple. One was burned with frankincense, one was burned with cannabis. And the cannabis was likely burned to Asherah. Robert Graves suggested this, the poet and scholar, who wrote books, Rafael Fatai, who wrote the kind of the major book on the Hebrew goddess in the 60s, and first started going over some of the stuff about Asherah, which was quite controversial at the time, but is well accepted by biblical scholars now. And she's not the only goddess. You know, we have references to cannabis under the Assyrian and Akkadian names, Kanabu, in textual references to the goddess Ishtar, where a cannabis-infused beer was made. There's references to large amounts of cannabis given as an offering at the Temple of Inanna. And Asherah, another ancient Hittite goddess as well, had a salve made from cannabis, similar to the anointing oils, you know. And this all strengthens the idea that Asherah as well was part of this tradition. And all these goddesses likely go back to an identical goddess that just kind of separated over time in different regions and took on a bit of their own flavor. Well, there's enough commonalities with them that it's well believed that they originated in a much earlier goddess and then just kind of split off into their own traditions as they went into different regions. So there's a long-standing tradition with the goddess, you know, and a large part of the suppression and what happened with cannabis, this temple in Tel Arad, was purposely canceled. They went in there and in a day knocked over these altars, buried them in sand, and built a new floor on it. That's why this material was so well preserved, because it was purposely covered up and cantered and buried in a day. Sat that way and for 2,800 years until people dug it up and rediscovered it. And it was believed that this site was canceled because of the worship of Asherah at it as they moved into monotheism, the worship of one single god, which was a total power move, a method of control. You know, there was no division between religion and politics in those days. And when you're dealing with a polytheistic religion where there's a variety of gods and goddesses, it's very hard to control the populace because there's all these different groups vying for power. Monotheism solidified things into one unified rule, and there wasn't a lot of use for shamans coming down from the mountaintop with revelations all hopped up on ganja. It was more about rules and regulations and laws and how much you pay after that. And that didn't take place until, probably about the 6th, 7th century BCE, and quite late in the biblical storyline. And we know that this is the case not just from archaeological evidence, but even in the books of Kings and Chronicles. There's a lot of references to this. And then the final references to Canna in the Old Testament, in Jeremiah 6:20, the Canna is flatly rejected. What do I care for your Canna from a distant land? This is related to Jeremiah 44, where he blames the fall of Jerusalem on the people burning incense to the Queen of Heaven, which fits well with what I was saying about these ancient Near Eastern goddesses and the use of cannabis. And you mentioned the Eden mythology, and this is actually one of the last texts of the Old Testament written, although it appears at the front of the book. These books were not written from beginning to end. They were placed in order after years, centuries after they were written in most cases. And it's well believed by a number of scholars that this was a tool of propaganda against the earlier situation where the goddess and her tree of life were centrally worshipped. And we know that Hezekiah, who they believe destroyed the temple of Tel Arad and covered it up, in the Bible, he's described as going into the temple and taking out the brazen serpent which Moses had made because the people were burning incense to it. So that all kind of fits with the mythology of the Garden of Eden.
Yeah, and it seems to also kind of parallel the rise of the patriarchy as well, right? And
absolutely, it's totally intertwined with it. And when you talk about the suppression of cannabis and how that's affected the world, that's one thing. But when you talk about the secondary role, turning of women into possessions, the denial of the divine feminine, and how that has affected the world over the last millennia, it's brought us to this state that we are in now, where we are so separated from nature, we're destroying the planet with climate change, and we're so caught up in war, we're ready to head into the third and dealing with. And in many ways, I think that there's this whole scenario is replaying in our own time. We were told how bad cannabis was, but like the tree of knowledge and the tree of life, we partake of it and our eyes become opened and we become aware of the corruption of the state and those of authority, here's this plant, man, that we could heal this planet with. We could save our forests with. We could get rid of that Mideast oil with, which we can heal the sick and dying with. And, it's a miracle, man. It really is a miracle. I think there's a place where science and religion meet, and it's on that fertile soil that this tree of life grows. And it's not just the biblical tradition. We could take a look at Soma and Heoma, Soma of the Vedic religion and the Heoma of the Avesta religion, both of which came from early religions. But these are foundational things that led into Hinduism, Sikhism, Buddhism, Zoroastrianism. And, you know, we're talking about the foundation of the oldest existing religions in the world that are still around, and a powerful role for this entheogenic substance, which I think has been largely overlooked and not understood by scholars who have no familiarity with these types of plants.
Yeah, let alone the suppression of all this knowledge and everything. But this is great stuff. We got to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, I want to get a little bit more into the ancient history of cannabis, but also its ties to occultism and some of the 420 mythos right after this. Welcome back to Think Theory Radio. This is Damien, and today we are joined by cannabis author Chris Bennett. And we have a kind of a unofficial drinking game here on Think Theory Radio, or I guess today would be a smoking game. But we have certain words and subjects that kind of always come up on this show. And when I'm reading your articles this week, it's like everything you write about has keywords like the Scythians, ancient Egypt, and Freemasons. And I just thought that was great. So I wanted to get a little bit more into, speaking of one, is ancient Egypt and how far back cannabis goes with that.
In Egypt, you know, cannabis was known by the Egyptian name Shemshemet. Most of the use there is medical and topical. There's one reference where there may be a ritual incense reference, but most of it was medical use in regards to Egyptian references. There have been claims of Egyptian mummies that had cannabis, but it's mixed up with these other claims that they were also using cocaine, the plant cocaine comes from, and tobacco, which would be really controversial because these are new world plants. And so the research of the deep tissue analysis has been called into question in that regard, but which is unfortunate because, you know, it's complicated, so we can't really say that for sure. Those mummies have that evidence, but in regards, you know, they have found hemp fibers on a mummy in a tomb, and they found cannabis pollen in wine amphora from Egypt. So it shows that it must have been growing there at some point, 4,000 years ago. And there's numbers of medical recipes for this Shemshemet, which is the Egyptian name for cannabis.
Well, and that's another interesting thing is how you look back at the ancients and how they knew how to cultivate cannabis for, you know, not just for fiber and ropes and everything, but also the medicinal properties. And, you know, all these different cultures, Sumerians and the Scythians and the Egyptians were using it medicinally. And then, you know, at least in our lifetime, it's been fairly recent that it started that resurgence of using it medicinally. It seems like for such a long time, it's like the dark ages of cannabis being used for that purpose.
Well, you know, I would say there's always been bits of it going on, you know.
Yeah.
We know that they were growing good quality cannabis, like the cannabis that they discovered in ancient China from like 2,700 years ago, 2,800 years ago. It was cultivated for its psychoactive properties. It wasn't being cultivated for its fiber, where it was in other areas, right? You know what I mean? And and same with the cannabis, you know, they believe it was hashish, it was cannabis resin, at least in Tel Arad, Jerusalem. So obviously, there was some awareness of it.
Yeah.
Medical references, you know, for its treatment of epilepsy, which they call hand of ghosts in Asian Assyrians, and other maladies, aches and pains, you know, stiffened limbs and that sort of thing. Definitely medical references to that. In China, you know, the first anesthetic was believed to be a cannabis-infused wine. That's about 100 AD. But even the medieval period, there was a 12th-century pope who wrote a treatise on medical cannabis, applying it for a number of reasons. Paracelsus, the noted alchemist, had a recipe with cannabis in it for epilepsy again. And, you know, when you're talking about things like epilepsy, man, it was miraculous for people to see that used and just as miraculous as it is today. I get some parents and they're like, you know, getting killed from the seizures that they're having from epilepsy. And here's this medicine that just shuts it right down. That's a miracle now. And that was a miracle for people in the ancient world as well. When that sort of thing took place. And, you know, a lot of these Assyrian medical recipes and Egyptian medical recipes often came with spells and prayers and things like that, because it was all kind of part and parcel of the same thing, you know?
Yeah. And speaking of, you know, the medicinal properties, but also you were mentioning the psychoactive properties and, like, spiritualism, it makes me wonder, as I was reading some of your work, it's almost like the chicken and the egg for me. I don't know if you know more, you know, how does it tie into the spiritual traditions as far as, you know, like, which came first? You know, were the ancients getting high and then seeing God, or, you know, or was it vice versa? You know?
That religion starts with plant-based shamanism, you know, and I mean probably not just cannabis, but probably a variety of substances. With cannabis, we've got some really good solid evidence and also textual references to its role, right? You know, we know that, you know, like the, not just in the Hebrew, but in the Assyrians, it's clearly the cannabis, which was known as Kanabu there, was clearly part of the sacred rites. It appears in direct references as one of the items for the sacred rites, and it also appears in lists of offerings for the temple that were to be delivered and things like that. So we know directly that the spiritual experience was there. And then, you know, in India, in the Vedas, you know, Soma was the inspiration for the Vedas. And this is a sacred drink, and I have a book, Cannabis and the Soma Solution, where I put forth a lot of archaeological and textual evidence making the case for cannabis and that. Other plants have been suggested. R. Gordon Wasson suggested the fly agaric mushroom. Others have suggested Syrian rue, other plants as well. And I go over why I disagree and the evidence that I brought forth for that. You know, people can decide for themselves. But nonetheless, it was a psychoactive substance. That much is really clear, you know. And, you know, even in India today, there's remnants of this. The oldest continually worshipped god on earth is Shiva, and cannabis is still offered to Shiva to this day at the Shiva Ratri and the Kumbh Mela and other festivals, you know. So, yeah, it goes way back. I kind of think when you take a look at this profound role, right, in the earliest days of written religion, it's pretty clear that there's a connection here, you know, and it's when we separated from these things that really God went silent, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you can see where the kind of fell out of way of use with the Hebrews, and it's like after that, man, that was the end of the age of prophets, you know.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I see that parallel too. Like, you know, I was talking about earlier, is, you know, the kind of the rise, you know, death of the, you know, the matriarchy, you know, kind of persecution of women, but also this kind of persecution of cannabis itself. And I don't know if back then you would call it, you know, illegalization or whatever, but, and this kind of destruction of free thought as well, you know.
And, you know, I think all this comes up again when we, you know, like we drift away, it disappears, you know, but then say at Napoleon's time when they're over in Egypt and French soldiers started trying hashish and brought it back to Europe, there was this whole new wave of spirituality that gave birth to the modern occult movement. Mm-hmm. And many foremost figures of occult history, Helena Blavatsky, Aleister Crowley, George Gurdjieff, a whole variety of important individuals in the history of occult, the founding figures of it, were experimenting with hashish as well. And this was hugely influential in how that whole scene came to rise, you know?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, too, when you think about a lot of the occultism, the mystery schools kind of follow this, you know, hermetic wisdom and these, you know, kind of imitating the ancient Egyptians and Sumerians and that kind of culture. But one that I love to talk about on the show is the Scythians, because I feel like they're the kind of unknown culture, you know, historically, even though they were very important. And I don't know if it's kind of they were the first ones to hotbox cannabis, right?
Yeah. Well, certainly Indo-European. The Scythians are like an Indo-European group, but Indo-European is the root language of all sorts of languages, French, English, German, Sanskrit, you know. And the root term for cannabis, canna, is even older than the Indo-European language. And that's why there's really between the term cannabis and chandra and hump, all these words, you know, you can etymologists can show how they all originated from the same earlier word. But cannabis was already, even at before the Indo-European language, there was a word for cannabis that got adopted into the Indo-European language. And this is the Proto-Indo-European language. And this is over the Ukraine region where the Sredeni Sog are believed to have been the first people to domesticate the horse. And that's believed to have taken place through the development of hemp ropes, which enabled them to grab them and corral them and ride them, you know. And we have evidence there, and these are the ancestors of the Scythians going back, you know, 5,500 years, that cannabis was used in funerary rites. And the Scythians, we know, had been using it in funerary rites because Herodotus, the Greek historian, wrote about this in the 5th century BCE and described a Scythian rite, funerary rite, where they would burn cannabis in a brazier in a tent and inhale the fumes. And in the 1940s, a Russian archaeologist digging up Scythian tombs found all these implements, the teepee-like structure used for holding the smoke, the brazier where the cannabis was burnt. And this was really widespread practice by Indo-Europeans. And we also know that this same technique at funerary practice was used by Indo-Europeans in China. And this is these references to the cannabis braziers and cannabis found in China. That was about 2,700 years ago. That was in the news for a while. And these were Indo-European-speaking people living in China from about 2,000 to 400 BCE, and they were using it exactly the same way as Scythians, going back to these Romanian and Ukraine finds. So this shows a really widespread tradition among these Indo-European cultures that split off into different groups, and where they went, they brought cannabis with them. And this has a lot to do with the spread of cannabis in the ancient world. It's thought that even the Hebrew use of cannabis is an offshoot of this, because the Hebrew term canna is thought to be an adoption of the Indo-European term canna for cannabis. And it was described as coming in on trade routes and stuff, which the Scythians pervaded. And we know the Scythians were in the Holy Land from archaeological evidence of their being there. There used to be a town, Theopolis, in Israel as well. They are a very important group, you know?
Yeah, totally. And you mentioned Herodotus, and I thought... No, go ahead.
Yeah, they smoked it. They also drank it. When there's the golden goblets. And these are sometimes misrepresented as bongs in the press, but they're actually infusions of cannabis and sometimes opium as well. So they were drinking it as well as smoking it.
Yeah, and they made like a kind of like a milk, like cannabis milk,
yeah.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, basically Soma, Haoma. One of the nicknames of the Scythians was the Haoma Varga, the Haoma Gatherers. And Haoma is the Avestan drink that's comparable to the Vedic drink Soma. That's thought to come from the same earlier tradition.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I know, just because you brought up Herodotus, it just made me think of he has two writings about, I thought he's like the ancient cannabis writer, because he wrote about the Scythians getting high, and I don't know if he got high with them or not, but he also wrote about the Dogon tribe in Africa, too, and their cannabis traditions. I thought it was kind of interesting. But back to occultism, and how does cannabis factor into, occult wisdom and these kind of secret societies?
Well, you know, like in the magical tradition, for instance, probably the oldest Western magical text is the Picatrix, which was a translation of an Arabic book, the Gayat al-Hakim, written in the 10th century. In the 13th century, the King of Spain had it translated into Latin, and it's a very important magical text. And it has recipes for, you know, cannabis hashish to be used in a ritual to invoke the servant of the moon, as well as other drugs and stuff. And numbers of, like, grimoires, like the Book of Oberon and Sefer Raziel, Lieber Salomonis, they have recipes that have cannabis in them for mirror strawing, which was a very popular combination of cannabis and mirror strawing. Alchemy-wise, when I first started writing Lieber 420, I thought the majority of the book would be all this 19th century occult stuff, and I'd just maybe be able to scratch a chapter out about the medieval and Renaissance period. But once I started digging into it and doing some deep research, I just came across this whole major tradition of both magical and alchemical texts that had direct references to cannabis. And I was able to find Latin alchemical texts where they have recipes for cannabis quintessences, which was basically a tincture of cannabis. But all this type of stuff led to chemistry as well, right? Chemistry is a direct result of alchemy. And the desire to find out what was causing the effects of plants like cannabis and opium and trying to get it down to the essence that was producing these effects, right, and divided out of the rest of the plant. This is how chemistry started, you know, and Robert Hooke and Robert Boyle and others at the Royal Academy were very interested in these substances, and it's pretty clear that this was a major inspiration for them as they moved us into the chemical age.
Yeah, and with the alchemists, who knows how many recipes there were, because they used to use so many different codes and symbolism, you know, in their recipes. But you mentioned in one of the videos I was watching of you, John Dee, is one of my, you know, is like my favorite alchemist, because this guy was, you know, he's like this magician, mathematician, but he worked for the church and the queen and, you know, his portal to speak to angels and everything. I didn't realize he had ties to cannabis as well.
Yeah, well, like there's, you know, accounts of his workings with Kelly, his assistant. And they're, you know, talking to an interview. They're mirror scribes, right? And we know time period grimoires from when they were alive, like the Sefer Raziel, Lieber Salomonis, and the Book of Oberon, and other grimoires have direct references to cannabis for mirror scrying, which is what they were doing. But, you know, in one account, Kelly's trying to talk to an entity in the mirror, and the entity's going, well, where's the drugs? And he shows him his empty apothecary box. I haven't got any drugs. The ghost is like, well, have you got any salves or anything? and give him any information without that. You know, it's probably more like Kelly priming D to produce some substances so Kelly can see something, you know?
That's great. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, I want to get into some of the 420 mythos, H.P. Lovecraft and Aleister Crowley, and some more with Chris Bennett here on Think Theory Radio. Welcome back to Think Theory Radio. This is Damien, and today we are joined by cannabis activist, author, and historian Chris Bennett. And we've been talking about the ancient origins of cannabis, some of its ties to occultism and medieval alchemy. I want to bring it a little bit into the 20th century, not yet the 21st century, but I read one of your articles about H.P. Lovecraft and Aleister Crowley and these kind of weird little ties to 420. I thought it'd be interesting to bring up. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, this is like synchronicity, I would say, you know. And in the story in The Walls of Erech, written in 1936 by Lovecraft, he describes this weird situation with the mirage plant. I'll read you a couple of excerpts from it. I had encountered at last one of those curious mirage plants about which so many of our men told stories. Anderson had warned me of them and described their appearance very closely, the shaggy stalk, the spiky leaves, and the mottled blossoms whose gaseous, dream-breeding exhalations penetrate every existing make of mask. And then Lovecraft goes on to have one of his main characters have the following experience on the plant at precisely 420. Although everything was spinning perilously, I tried to start in the right direction and hack my way ahead. My route must have been far from straight, for it seemed hours before I was free of the mirage plant's pervasive influence. Gradually, the dancing light began to disappear, and the shining, shimmering, spectral scenery began to assume the aspect of solidity. When I did get wholly clear, I looked at my watch and was astonished to find the time was only 4:20. Through eternity had seemed to pass. The whole experience could have consumed little more than a half hour. You know, and we know that, you know, people that Lovecraft was close with, like Clarke Ashton Smith and Robert E. Howard, had experimented with hashish. Ashton Smith wrote a short story, The Hashish Eater, and Robert E. Howard, who created Conan the Barbarian, he wrote an account of his own influences, his own experience under the influence with the hashish as well. So it must have been around that scene somewhat. In the case of Crowley, he recorded an event in his New York flat on April 20th, 1918, where they ate hashish. And this is part of his famous ML Entra working, where he was, you know, some people believe that he contacted aliens. But describes a definite account there with him and some of his followers where they get really high on hashish on 420.
Nice. And I know you said Aleister Crowley had a big party on 420 back in the day too, didn't he?
Oh, well, he didn't, this was like a particular event, ML-TRA working. Mm-hmm. He also had, the rites of Eleusis, which weren't necessarily performed on 420, but they did involve, it was like a celebration where they ingested mescaline and other substances as well, and kind of trying to bring back the ancient Eleusian mysteries.
And you've been writing about Aleister Crowley. The book, Liber 420 is kind of an homage to his, Magic Liber, is that right?
Well, it started, you know, like I did have a chapter, like a whole big chapter on Crowley was the first thing I wrote for Liber 420, but then I didn't end up using it in there. I got a mentions of him, but I've written some extensive articles on it, and I may write a book on it at some point. I was researching and planning on writing a book, and just to be honest with you, I was reading so many diary notes and personal letters, I kind of got turned off of them in that scene there. he had a brilliant mind. He's like a egotistical, he wasn't a good friend to people that treated him well. And I just kind of got put off of it. But I do have some interesting articles about Crowley's relationship with hashish in my blog, as well as people like Richard Wagner, who was a big influence on Crowley as well, the famous opera writer of Parsifal and other music cool plays, but he as well as was an experimenter with hashish as well. I just kind of got put off that scene, and then this material came about from Telerad in 2020, and so I decided to spend my time revisiting all this ancient Hebrew stuff that I'd written about before, now that the archaeological evidence was there to document it.
And that was all for the last book that you put out, right? The Lost Sacrament?
Yeah. But I still may at some point pick up this information about Crowley, because it is a fascinating history, the whole role of hashish back in his scene as well. And I think that many people don't realize how pivotal cannabis was to his philosophy and vision of magic.
Now, with the last book, I mean, you just put that out last year, and I know you put a ton of research into that. You've explained a little bit about it, but what else can you tell us about what you've researched in that book that are things that, like, people would just, you know, not have heard at all? I mean, which is most of what we're talking about anyway, but you know what I mean?
I've written about these Hebrew references from this etymologist and anthropologist, Sula Bennett, the Hebrew terms canon, cannabossum, were, as I mentioned earlier, were cannabis in other books, right? And it's kind of a fascinating tale because it shows, when you follow these references in the context of the biblical storyline, It tells the story of a plant that was once an important, celebrated part of the religious life that came to be completely rejected. And this is all wound up with how the Hebrews went from a polytheistic religion, which is the worship of a variety of deities. You know, Yahweh has his wife Asherah. There's other deities worshipped alongside of them. It's one big family of gods and goddesses. Into a monotheistic religion, and cannabis plays a really important role in all that. So that's all kind of laid out there, as well as this whole history of Asherah and how that's interrelated with it as well. Other stuff in there is like Ezra, the prophet Ezra, who's thought to have been the one that put the Old Testament text together. He'd been a vassal of the Persians, and they were worshippers of the Zoroastrians, and we know at that time the Zoroastrians, there's textual references to them drinking cannabis-infused wine as a means of revelation, and there's a scene in Ezra before he puts the Old Testament together where he drinks a cup of fire, and two different researchers more than a century apart have suggested that this was a cannabis-infused wine. That's another important element. And cannabis-infused wines were really big in the ancient world. There's numbers of references to it. We found evidence of archaeological evidence of cannabis-infused wines going back to 5,200 years in Spain. Evidence of cannabis-infused wines have been found in France as well. And also, as I mentioned, you know, Scythian sites. So, you know, this is another major kind of way of ingesting. I think probably what I'm most known about is for the suggestion that Jesus may have healed with cannabis. Mm. And the term Christ is a Greek translation of the Hebrew term Messiah. It means the anointed one. And the first of these cannabis references, Exodus 30:23, God first appears in flames of fire within a bush, commands Moses to make this holy anointing oil with about 6 to 9 pounds of this cannabis mixed with myrrh, cinnamon, and cassia. And every time he's to speak to the Lord, he goes into the tent of the meeting, a small enclosed space like the Scythian tents. He puts this oil on his body, and THC is fatty soluble, can pass through the skin, which is a big organ. He also places some of this oil on the altar of incense. And he speaks to the Lord in the pillar of smoke over the altar of incense. And that's pretty radical, you know, to throw cannabis into that, because then it takes it away. It's like God, is he supposed to speak to some omnipotent, discarnate God, or is he like a shaman that uses a psychoactive substance to bridge the metaphysical gap? And I think that, you know, this Telluride evidence shows cannabis resonance in exactly the same sort of context, right? So that's pretty important. But this anointed one, as I mentioned, Christ is the Messiah, which means the anointed one, makes direct reference to this same anointing oil that's referred to in Exodus 30:23. And Jesus baptizes none of his disciples, but in the oldest of the synoptic gospels, Mark, he sends them out with oil to cast out demons and heal the sick. And casting out demons in those days could be something like treating epilepsy, which I mentioned was a miracle in the ancient world, and healing the sick. You know, and we find references to this in the Gnostic Christian text as well. Jesus gives his disciples a box full of unguents and balms, and he tells them, you got to heal the body first before you can heal the soul, and sends them out there as well with materials to do that, you know. And I think that's pretty radical, you know. Like, yeah, it's pretty clear that it's more than a mere laying of hands when he cures a blind man, uses a clay poultice. So there's obviously medicinal type stuff involved. And that's a pretty radical revelation, I think, for our time period and everything that's happening, you know, in the world right now, that Jesus could have healed with this plant. And, you know, the evidence of Telluride is not the only archaeological evidence. We have evidence from 4th century Common Era from Bet Shemesh, Jerusalem. And this was medical cannabis used topically, just as I'm suggesting that this was how Jesus would have used it, and also burnt. In this case, it was a young woman who died during childbirth, and they were using the cannabis to try and aid her to have the baby, but she died. But it shows that this medicinal use of cannabis goes back right to that time period in that area of the world as well.
And you made me think of two things. One, you brought up cannabis-infused wine, and then Jesus, and then I thought about the whole, you know, they make you drink wine as like the, you know, the blood of Christ or whatever. And, you know, was it cannabis-infused wine? You know,
well, like there are definite references in the Gnostic text to, you know, describes Jesus in the Book of Jude putting vines into wine bottles, you know, and drinking it, and the account of Marcus, a Gnostic figure, he's drinking an infused wine, and his thing is clearly that he's adding drugs to the wine. So I think there is a case for that, you know, in the popular book, The Immortality Key, was the idea that Jesus was influenced by the Dionysian tradition, was using some sort of drug wine. Now, there's some interesting information in regards to Dionysius tradition and cannabis. You know, it's thought that Dionysius and Shiva originate from the same earlier god by some scholars. And this goes back to, like, ancient times. They talked about this. Roman and Greek times, they were talking about the connection between Dionysius and Shiva. Shiva's worship, Dionysius' worship starts with the Thracians, and it's the first sacrament was an incense. And we know the Thracians burned cannabis. They had a type of priesthood, the capnobody, those who walk and smoke, and were related to the Scythian shamans. So there's this whole major tradition in there as well that's pretty founded.
Yeah, and another thing you said was talking about this kind of departure from God as, you know, something more metaphysical, something crossing the boundaries of reality into, you know, we get rid of the kind of the cannabis ritual within these spiritual religions and replace it with this kind of ruled structure and dominant, you know, the male runs things and, you know, kind of, even though it's still spiritual, but it kind of broke away from that kind of mindset of being more higher dimensional.
The modern placebo, you know what I mean? The bread and wine, you know, they don't have the same power as these ancient sacraments that were really used, in my opinion, you know. And that type of stuff takes the power of spirituality away from the individual, places it in the hands of a priesthood who gets to meter it out. And I think that the beauty of entheogenic substances is a direct experience the individual can attain with them.
Yeah. And what is, I know you, right, we didn't get into this. What is entheogenic? What is that for people that don't know?
And yeah, this is a term that a number of scholars like Carl Ruck and Jonathan Ott and others, R. Gordon Watson, came up with because they were unhappy with words like psychedelic and hallucinogenic to describe the substances used, say, at the Eleusinian Mysteries or other, you know, the Soma and things like that. Entheogen, when you break down the words, it means God created within, and that these substances inspire one, you know, in that sort of a way. So they wanted something, a word that kind of helped to identify that kind of contextual use.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I had never heard of that word until I started reading some of your work. I thought it was pretty interesting to have a kind of a more scientifical, constructed definition of what, you know, cannabis and these other psychoactive plants are.
You know, I would say in the last 30 years, things have come a long way in that regard. I would say that, you know, the idea of these types of substances playing a role in the formation period of the world religion was kind of poo-pooed a little more when I first started writing, but now it's becoming widely accepted, and it's a topic, you know, that people can write their university theses on and not get kicked out.
Yeah, right.
For anyone.
Not lose their tenure. Right? We gotta wrap it up, and I just want to thank you for coming on the show. And if you want to give people some information on how to get in touch with you and how to get your books or read your articles, let them know.
Sure, yeah, you can, you know, follow me on Facebook. If you search my name in cannabis in Google, you'll come up with lots of articles. Or if you put my name in cannabis in YouTube, you'll find documentaries and interviews and that sort of stuff. And I have a blog over at cannabisculture.com where I post a lot of historical information. But, yeah, if you follow me on social media, when anything news comes about, I find out about it. I usually post about it. Recently, they found a Roman pot with burnt cannabis in it. So there's stuff like that I'm always finding out about.
That's great, man. And thanks again, Chris, for coming on. That's going to wrap it up for Think Theory Radio. We'll be back again next week and every Saturday, 6 to 7 p.m. right here on WCPT 820. Happy 420, everybody.